received apologies from representatives from the Department of Public Enterprise, the see if what well, do you think we can factor that means that we just told us all that to you. Just the distinction.
Yes. I think maybe maybe we should just systematically go through everything. The definition that they've done, the definition and go through objects of a few in that sequence.
Okay. Now, that was still done, that's how we've been where to issues around the object. That, I'm sorry, definition.
Page 4.
From page 4. Oh, sorry, you have corrected me. I want to say what I saw as question to a definition. There, I said, oh, what's it? That is a central question. Okay. Well, the arrangement of section is there. We may address ourselves only if we need to later down the line. Can you go straight to chapter 1, definitions and objects of the act? That is definition. Any comments on the first page? From 35 down to 45, 46.
If it's a term that understood generally by those in the field, it's fine. I want to end up defining each and every term that we are not familiar with here. And that this is supposed to be used by those in that environment.
No, that's fine. Okay, let's go to page 4 in the bill.
can we get just a brief explanation on the 24, on the next page 5, that's point 24 that I read by ESCOM, where the department agrees that it's important to ensure that this module does not depend on new definitions under either
line.
I think they could be alluding to under the deal, under the definition, the difference of ERA under the license and I think various cases.
The comment there was in oracular line meaning the word secret code, which means the secret code was necessary to that extent. So in terms of the department, what we have done is that we have aligned it in time.
So members, nothing to raise in page 4 for now.
Yeah.
In the deal. And in terms of the matrix, nothing to read for now in page 4. Okay. Let's move in the deal to page 5.
Section 2, the ESCOM submission here indicates that certain parts of the object should be deleted, that is maintenance, and the department is agreeing that that it should be removed. I already understood to indicate whether we are agreeing with that so that we should be able to proceed and that in future they can make the necessary changes. And maybe just to have a brief explanation from the department why they are agreeing that they will take more from us.
That's on page 8 of your matrix.
Just to say that we do agree with the input from ESCOM under the auspices that it was more of correcting language and then aligning with the whole flow of the document. Western culture to an Asian is a very good valid point. As it might be well known to others, it might not be well known to others, but can we just go with the state address and cross check whether we need the SOC or we then have to explain the acronym method?
I will share it also in line with the Companies Act, because I think this is a term we got from the Companies Act, which is good, well known, but I will just double check. It's like PTY LTD, so, but I will check.
No, in the Companies Act, yeah. We shifted from the old terms and we used some state old companies, but what I was asking, out of curiosity, in this the piece of legislation or processing now, I find if it's left as is, it's just as it would be. I'm looking at everyone.
Perfect. that Ismail should be responsible for generation training, and that the minister has the right to intervene. But the department holds a different view on section 4.1, that the IRP is the ministerial responsibility, and that the policy is the prerogative of the minister. Ismail has to make inputs in terms of scenario training and modeling for the purpose of IRP. So I'm just saying let's have an adequate explanation so that for the purpose of Tuesday's meeting, we shouldn't be going over the same thing all the time.
Okay, fine.
the debate. But if you say transmission operator, that bring a conflict with you?
Yeah.
Or confusion.
I think it's gonna bring some confusion, because the operator it might not necessarily own the land.
Okay.
It's a different sort of operator.
Okay.
But it depends on how it defines.
Okay. No, it's not a big issue.
I remember, I'm sure everyone might if we go along that after control B, we just have a reflection on the technicians once again. Because a couple of things can influence us, you know, at times to rethink, you know, some of the technicians, you know, we may have taken for granted for now to be quite okay. From our side, if you look at page 9 of the main 3, 45 and 46 in particular, I think what Professor has said is raising is that this one should have a new mature new generation capacity, and also that planning the procurement spaceship. The transformation should be integrated. Any comments on that? Because they refer to specific areas of the city. I'm just taking them as a lab because I see the indication data about adding such function. Comment?
Yeah, maybe starting from the responsibility in the status in terms of the era, in terms of planning. IRP, maybe IRP, the responsibility of planning is not the for IRP, so the department. Just to say that in terms of some of the stakeholders, which one are ESCOM and dispatching part of the ESCOM, is responsible for modeling. But when it comes to policy issues, it then becomes the responsibility of the department and ultimately approving and publishing the document. So on that regard, the comment by Prof. Eben Arsby said the procurement of generation of the new generation capacity and the other functions might have to go to the ISMO. Unfortunately, for now, the status is still the same, even on our proposal, the final approval and the ownership of the document becomes the department, which is responsible for policy.
Yeah, I think it would be helpful if the department can draw a distinction between the long-term procurement decision and the actual procurement that must be done by ISMO. Because in your response you say, Minister makes a determination for procurement of long-term generation capacity in terms of ERA, and ISMO will be responsible for actual procurement of long-term generation capacity. If you could explain the distinction between the two.
I think the comment by Professor Bahat, I think it relates to procurement of the long term electricity. I think the way he's saying it is that if you pay it, you must procure and pay the power.
the lay person's way so that I should be able to understand the situation. So you are saying, for instance, the minister, let's put figures here, there's 5,000 megawatts that must be there. The minister say, of coal. The minister say, 3,000 megawatts will be built by Eskom, and 2,000 megawatts will be built by Taipei. And that's where the determination of the minister ends. From there is the responsibility of ISMO to go into the procurement and coming on the transaction with Eskom and the IPP.
Yes, thanks. I think you got it. I think the only thing that is left is that the minister will take it even further and say, you, ISMO, will be the procurer and you will be the buyer of the power from there. If ISMO probably doesn't have a balance sheet at that point, I'm just making an example now. My trade has gone to you, will be fine. ISMO will do the procurement, which means ISMO will be doing what DOE is doing now, and then so on.
Okay.
I think the explanation that I thought they sort of covered part of it, but I think we should sort of understand the initial comment where it says plainly should be a function of ISMO. Because you see they say integrated planning, procurement, pension, dispatch and selling should be together. And I'm sort of explaining why you can't put planning in there. You can only put certain elements of planning into ISMO that deals with the actual modeling and stuff like that. But in terms of the policy input, those policy input should come from government. And that's why we felt we should split the planning function into two categories. One being the module part, which is done by ISMO, and the policy adjustment being done by government. And the procurement, we are sort of explaining now that, you know, we also sort of kind of, we don't split the procurement, but it's depending on the situation on the ground. The minister will do the determination of how to say, okay, this is how it's going to work, and this is what's going to split it into two categories, being as small as the other. The patients, I think that will actually be more to the patients. However, we should be careful with the patients as well, because we're going to implement it in phases that will be that good. But that patient will only happen at a particular point in time. And then the dispatch and the selling. I think it's a nice concept that all these things they come together, but in our environment we need to be careful about certain policy parameters that we need to control as a country, even in terms of emission and stuff like that. We need to keep it close. We don't want to let it get mad with it. All of a sudden we've got pollution issues that we can't control because now we've got somebody else doing that kind of.
Okay, fine.
Move around.
8% here, we have got a committee resolution on transmission grid, which then for anything that relates to that question of transmission grid should be addressed by the committee, I mean committee resolution, because we said this is how we process the bill, and then anything related to call to transmission, they would be addressed through that resolution. Or the department that went with the kind of call of the details of this. That is the resolution that we have.
Now that's on record.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now it's on record that that's how we're going to deal with it. Okay. Anything else around function? So that we can round up section 4. I see there's a lot around this kind of meter from just the inputs in page 10 and 11. And I see also the department of correspondence quite elaborately to project 90 in page 10 in the matrix.
Done in consultation with you, and it's more
Remember, that's the mention of the companies at now, the term which we were talking about, the SOC. I have checked the section 11.3(c)(4) of the Companies Act. It is prescribed that all the state-owned companies must be written in that way, that SOC. So it can be written in full. It's a, they must end with that phrase.
So
the SOC, another thing that we reflect for Tuesday. So I've checked section 11 of the Companies Act, and it's prescribed that all state-owned companies must end with that stock in capital.
Already, that's from I think something like that. Okay. What is the
example? Yeah, I'm just saying, Chairperson, on the point that has been raised by the department on the issues of Companies Act and the particular, that issue is one in the establishment of ISMO and memorandum of incorporation, because I recall that ESCOM was saying that they are not necessary to be repeating some of the things that are, I think they have been using around fiduciary duties, but it's still something that we can still come to at a later stage, whether we want to leave that and accept that all companies, whether they are SOCs or fiduciary limited, have to comply with what is stated in the company. But I'm just saying, at a later stage, Chairperson, when we with other sections that are people, I just have them committee on the issue of instead of defining efficiency. Because I would assume that the, you know, it's a commonly used phrase. I think it's, we'll end up defining everything.
I also agree that dictionary words will have their dictionary meaning, don't need to be really defined.
And I would assume the Electric Characterization Act, one way or another, does address that. What I'm asserting is fact. Okay, fact. I would draw it.
We are not taking that on board, and also there was an issue. So many things. So an issue about, I think this is, I think you should understand where these comments are coming from. The latest comments, when they're saying the old bill must be green, being that they are referring to the bill that came to Parliament before, you know, that went to the central advisor before it was passed. So, but when what is the central advisor process, we cannot find the bill, and then we came up with a basis that is specified by the central advisor. And they are arguing that that's the base setting. And we are saying, you know, we have to look at these things, and we have refined it in an attempt to make those alignments that we saw. And in that section, I think section 76, section 43A, they are saying inconsistent with the IRP and IRA. We I think some of these sections, you will see that there's a very thin line between what should be in the era and what should be here. And we believe that that's already provided for anyway in section 3. And
do we have section 3E?
I think that's 4, 3. What we have done, saying provided for in section 4.3, the IRP refers to the IRP.
Okay.
It's a kind of, because if you look at, it refers to the IRP, and when you look at the definition of the IRP, it says defining era, when you get to era, and so on. You sort of completed the whole book, but it's sort of for those that go back to where it comes from. And there's a deletion there in 4.3.D.2. When I tell that, you will be in 1.10.8. But that's where it is. And then 5 to reinstate the original text on the Royal Island of Incorporation. I think this is what we have said we will have to look at when we get to that section anyway. They are saying we should reinstate the old text of that, which is the text that we went through with the central advisor and tied to. I think they say that those kind of contradictions in terms of the input that comes in, and some that they put less content into that section that deals with incorporation of the entity and rely mainly on the Companies Act, and some say we should actually reinsert that and have a more explanation on how this is going to happen, and we're sort of saying we're going to go with the current version as it stands. Looking at my state of information last year. But if you look at the section, I think it's section 5. If you look at the section, we are very narrow. I think probably it's a 3-paragraph kind of section. We are very narrow on what should happen. And in fact, we are saying this moment, draft the memorandum of incorporation. And we are sort of saying, despite the Companies Act and amendments, we will not offer interest. In principle, we are saying this. Okay, the moment of incorporation, it comes from the Companies Act itself. It's not a new concept that we are introducing here. And we are sort of then referring it
understand and not practical. For instance, let me read the sentence. It says, whenever the chaplain is absent or unable to perform his or her function as chaplain, the deputy chaplain must act as chaplain. And if the deputy chaplain is absent or unable to act as chaplain, the minister must need another member of the board to act as chaplain until the chaplain or deputy chaplain are available. Let's look from a practical situation. The chaplain of the board is in the hospital. The deputy chaplain of the board is flying from Cape Town to Victoria for the mission. And the flight is delayed, and it said that okay, the final decision from SAA, they are not allowed to depart for some weather. And the minister is in Beijing now. So we must then call the minister in Beijing. The minister is in a serious meeting with the government of Beijing, I mean of China. So we then must say, for the protectors or the chief of staff who's traveling with the minister, can you whisper to the minister here to write a quick memo, then appointing Mr. Maduna as the acting chairperson for the board, and actually the board is in sitting waiting for that memo from you authorizing Mr. Maduna to be the acting chairperson. That's not practical. I think the most advisable thing, I agree with you, the chairperson of the board in the absence of the chairperson of the board, the deputy chairperson must chair the meeting. But if the meeting has got a quorum, then the members of that board must elect the acting chairperson among themselves. But to say that the minister who is in Beijing must then fact select, giving advocate Banara the authority to go and chair the board meeting, I think it's not practical.
I think what needs to happen is probably we need to look at a section that deals with that. We need to add another clause that deals with that so that they can appoint a chairperson while waiting for the minister to appoint. You start saying in the absence of both the deputy and in the absence of the chairperson and the deputy chairperson, therefore the members may appoint for a chairperson, which will then act as the chairperson. But am I advisor with the chairperson?
The thing is, practically speaking, the meeting is for board meetings are normally a little bit more. They start at 9, 10, by 1 o'clock they finish. So it's just for that period. So if we then say the minister must still ratify that decision after the effect, the meeting has to swear. So that's my challenge. I like allowing the board for the purpose of that meeting, because we are not electing an acting chairperson for 2 weeks or 3 weeks. We are electing an acting chairperson for the purpose of the duration of that meeting. So after that meeting, the chairperson of the board is still the chairperson. If he's still in the hospital, the deputy chairperson missed the flight. The deputy chairperson will still be available for another meeting after 4 weeks, because board meetings will typically meet 4 times a year. So the deputy chairperson of the board will still be available for the next meeting of the board if the chairperson is not yet out of hospital.
I think we can advocate.
Because if we say the minister must ratify, it's just for the purpose of that meeting, for that 3-hour meeting of the board, and then the meeting is dispersed.
Yes.
But there is something that you have to be careful.
No, they have to. Okay.
Thank you, Sherry. We look at it. The problem that I'm understanding with 11, it looks like it's broader than meeting. It's like the chairperson and the whole function. So if we're dealing with specifically meetings, that can be done. But we must check also in terms of the overall functions of the chairperson, because it looks like clause 11 is limited to is broader, actually, not limited to chairing the meeting.
Let's talk about, let's use practical example. I don't know any SOC where the serpent doesn't have sword, any other power that is different from the other directors in that of that war. The serpent doesn't have any other authority except facilitating the meeting. And the second power of the chairperson is to possibly sign the minutes. You know, say the minutes are correct reflection of what we discussed that day. So it will be limited to signing of minutes, and then possibly the signing of decisions, confirming that these were the decisions of the board. Then the chairperson is given those powers by the board. But I don't know, something that we have to consider. Maybe, yeah.
Is there an expectation according to this deed that the chairperson should do other functions such that this requirement is set? Because in terms of just chairing meetings, I think we're all in agreement about the industrial consequences. But if then, according to this deed, there are other expectations of what the chairperson should be doing, then can you address that?
Sir, can I request that we look at it and we'll come up with a proposed way in terms of how to
thank you. Okay, move.
But I think in principle,
G-I-U-G. Because generally boards are responsible for strategy of the company. They are in charge of the business. And they set the strategy. The CEO must implement the strategy of the company. So I think everything that's written here in relation to the powers of the board, because it's very clear in section 9, the board is responsible for managing the business and affairs of ISO. But the practical implication would have to be done by the CEO and the staff, and the responsibility of the board is to oversee the implementation of that strategy. So I think everything that's written here, I find it to be in order. The consensus with the ideas, but maybe it could mean what you're saying, but also it could mean that the non-executive directors that you appoint there shouldn't be holding too many positions somewhere to the extent that they are not giving sufficient time to ISMO. It could mean anything, but I think this is the responsibility. The minister is finally responsible for the appointment of all non-executive directors. We have to check whether these people have got time available to dedicate to ISMO. But the other challenge, Chairperson, under section 13 that I have is somewhere where it's talking about geographical spread. I'm trying to check my highlighting. Yeah, it says in establishing a committee, the minister must ensure that the committee is broadly representative of the various social groups and geographical areas of the Republic of South Africa. The challenge is not racial groups, but just geographical areas. We need to specify that one, because then we can contest later. I can contest later, take the minister to call, and say this thing is not representative for all geographical areas of South Africa. Limpopo and Mpumalanga, I excluded from representation in this committee. Therefore, this thing is not represented. It's in Limpopo, it's in Mpumalanga, it's Northern Cape, and possibly Northwest. They are not part of your nomination committee. Therefore, this thing is not representative of the geographic areas of South Africa. Is it not better to leave it out? You know, what harm would it do if you leave it out? I understand that it could be a compromise settlement that was reached at the NSPEC, and I think we need to know that, but we shouldn't, as Parliament, then we are not obliged to go along with what NSPEC has stated. Because then, from this point that I've just been making on the nomination committee, you already have, 9 people from it already. So, and if you feel 9 people from provinces, the nomination committee now is maybe 9. Okay, you can qualify that we'll, among those 9, we'll start to look at issues of racial diversity and expertise. Is that the nomination committee, the size of the nomination committee that you want? Already you're prescribing yourself that this is the nomination committee that you want. Hence my early argument that I don't think I understand the lobbying and whatever between labor and business around this issue. Please consider that, and maybe on Tuesday let's have a further discussion. Because if there's no harm in taking out this thing, because the nomination committee's purpose is just to help the minister to arrive at the right decision of choosing non-executive directors. It's just about recommending names of non-executive directors after looking at section 4, and section 4 qualifies who should then become a non-executive director.
We take 88. I think that one of the
extra meeting.
No, we can't have extra
meeting. So you just get used to it.
Yeah, I am used to it.
Thank you. neither here nor there. It's just in terms of the question, what do you want in terms of the question? Otherwise, it's still a belief, it's nothing.
Yeah.
Just stick to one thing that you still will be able to do that. What harm does it do to everything? We're not contradicting this company. Shall is no longer used. You notice that shall appears in the older act and older legislation. And then now we use may to give discretion and must when we're directing. So it's may or must. We're not using shall throughout this legislation. So now we are giving a discretion there to the minister by using may. So we cannot say must or shall.
Okay.
Okay. we can put court by court of laws and then change it for drafting purposes. So that it's not just like any court and tennis court. So you can say by a court of law.
You know what you can do in a court of law is that you said, my lord, what was meant by this? Do you mean a tennis court? Do you mean a court of rugby players? Not a fan. Okay, move.
Thank you, Chair. On 19, is the whole issue about judiciary responsibility, and it's an issue that these things are covered in the Companies Act. And we're of the view that we need to mention some of the key things that we expect to comply with, even though most of the things are covered in the Companies Act. But it's our view that whatever we're saying here is going to not contrast to the company. And therefore, it's not necessary to just remove everything and leave the act blank around the entire responsibility issues. Because people, no matter what they read an act, they hardly refer to the other legislation. So it might be proper to have this guidance on what are the issues that pertain to that particular subject without having to remove everything that seems to say and depend solely on the company thing. And we felt we should say something around that particular point.
No, sir, there's nothing much I can elaborate because it's just a purpose of emphasis to avoid at least the legislation to be empty and also to cross-refer too much, which could be confusing. So the important thing is that you will not conflict with the Companies Act. That is, if we're watching that, then there's no... But it's a policy decision. It depends on the committee. If the committee wants to emphasize, we fine. But there's nothing legal from a legal perspective that is going to cause harm to the sphere.
Okay, fine. Unless other members are around to feel to contrast, there's no harm in having it because there's a date and that.
Thanks, sir. 91 is it's a quorum issue. It's a point that was also debated very strongly in our own circle with regards to how the quorum should look like. There was a view that if you set the quorum below, you are making people to be busy, not to come late, or you want to be fine, so that people they know that if I'm not there, it means nothing will happen, so I must be there. And so it's a and also referred to that there was a view that you are looking at these members to contribute towards whatever decision that's being made. But if the quorum is a bit low, which means you might lose out on some inputs that you expected from the other board members. And yeah, I think that's where we sort of got to with those discussions and then we end up putting it away.
My concern is that it might hamper the function of the board, because I don't know what 70% of 10, it could be around 7%. So all the time you would have 7 members. So my problem is that why not just let it be an ordinary majority where your quorum should be formed by 50% plus one. And then if you're not happy about the attendance of your board members, they were appointed by the shareholder. A shareholder can decide at the end of the year to review the performance of every director. Did they attend the meeting? If not, you call them, you know, and put new board members. I don't know, but that's just my view. 17 months, yeah, they might meet, and only to find that they're fixed for that day. For one shot. You know, a board of 10 members, they are meeting, they are one shot. Because of something else that just arose in the normal course of business, and then the board must adjourn. Try another day.
So we can reduce it to majority. What other ones to come out with it as if because we had a little debate, you know, in the next as if I'm coming here to change some of the decisions that we sort of, you know, discussed.
The reason why I'm recruiting chairperson, the reason why I'm raising it, is I assume in the private sector, I think most companies would apply the simple majority rule. If 50% plus one of the board members are there, then they proceed. I would assume that the same applies with the SOC, I don't know. But in the private sector generally, the common practice, you have got a meeting, the quorum is 50 plus one. But here, I think we are almost like passing a constitution of the country. You know what I mean? The constitution. We want the 2/3 majority, therefore, I think it might be too much. Even parliament decisions, I think, are taken by 50 plus one, by a majority. Unless you are making the constitution of the country, then you can start to talk about 2/3 majority.
Done. Thank you, sir. Actually, if I can just give a background, when we received this EMOB bill from the department, it was after a time when we dealt with many establishments of many SOEs, and Parliament was very strict on this issue of the quorum. So I don't know, at the time, there was a frustration on the SABC and other SOEs, post office and others. So there was this general policy direction from Parliament that this must be done in terms of SOE, it needs to be stricter. So that is how I also based this on other models which were passed by Parliament, because there is one decision to be taken lightly and that there's a need to improve the state-owned companies. So, but it can be adjusted depending on the policy direction of the committee.
Hello, Kalan. What was the
trend? Mm-hmm.
If the what was the trend here in Parliament with regards to other SOEs? What are the trends in terms of the quorum? Were they think 70% or what they think is the conventional figure? What are the parameters?
In my bills, I came with the 50 plus 1, then Parliament, the trend was 70. 70% quorum came from Parliament. So that is how I based also this one, because on all my SOE that I was involved in the establishment, Parliament demanded an amendment that the 70 plus 1 to be stricter.
What do you say, Brad? I don't know about to punch you with a cup.
Yeah.
A lot of questions. I say, what informed you to do this? What is it that you have seen? Where is it taken? You know, okay. Now,
The drafters, just to do a bit of a scale and establish what they're getting with the other SOC, and maybe ESCOM, Transnet, all those staff call whatever, demand, how do they apply? But I'm sure, generally, with the private sector, the 50, that's what. Maybe, yeah, I don't know why members just 40%, I don't know.
Yeah, I think that some of the
people want that. We didn't start to talk about 35%.
No, I will follow it up. Oh, but all I can say that at the time when we processed all those bills, Parliament was very angry with the SOEs and everything that was happening, SAA, SABC, and all of the South African Post Office. So then the Parliament vowed that every legislation that is going to come before them is going to be, the standard is going to be upgraded and be amended to put the threshold to be high. Not just on the quorum, and many other and many other issues around the SOEs.
That I share all of that, that's so that we will be primed about that in time. Okay, we take a note of this. Okay. But also, I think what we need to hold on that is that is this the only remedy action to ensure conscientious contribution? Quality contribution, you know, at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, can I be provocative? Okay, you get the 7%. I make sure that I come in and I just warm the kitchen. And I let the usual people be talking.
And I
watch you. Yeah, and watch people, as you know, when we come from the organization, we know sometimes participation at times gets huge. I'm just throwing it, I know we'll just wait for other members to come. It gives us time as well. It gives a chance to collect information. But those are the things that are coming in mind. That yes, it may be that there is a reason and a rationale to ensure something is being remedied or must be remedied by upping the current business level.
I agree with you, because with normal companies, they would require the company, I mean, shareholders or in a way, would be putting a pressure to say, companies must do a board evaluation every year. So you want to evaluate the performance of your members every year. You know? And the thing that you want as a shareholder, like the Department of Energy, to be saying, if I see this trend, by the end of the year, I'm no longer confirming this one, they must be getting out. Because they are not attending. You see, if they say a serious oversight role on the SOC, people then take their responsibility seriously and say, we need to be there in those meetings. Otherwise, I'm recalled and it's not good for me, for my reputation as a director. Because it would have been known by others that I was recalled from Gizmo because of non-attendance.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So that's why I would just advise the committee then, even though despite the trend, then to adapt to the, according to the circumstances of this sector, because there may have been lots of problems in the communication sector, even government and other sectors. So it's best to just consider the circumstances of ISMO and the energy sector and take a policy decision within this committee.
Okay. Thanks for that.
The ABC board is a product of handling political lobbying. I'm not on record.
But I think also on the road, playing a role, you know, it might be to say as well, you sense our concerns, but in educated framework to ensure contribution, you know, contribution, quality leadership, effectiveness, and efficiency of the board. Okay, Carol.
Sometimes, but I just, if my colleague can just request, what is the purpose of the involvement of the minister in any way in the appointment of the committee?
Just to follow up on the state government, because I assume in government action shouldn't be arbitrary. There must be motivation for why they are doing certain things. And I think I was about to ask that question, but then I just thought, okay, let me rephrase. Because it should not be arbitrary, it should be about achieving a certain objective. There must be a motivation for it.
At the end of the day,
understanding was clause 18.2, which says the board must assign members to serve to the committees. It looks like it's only going to be members of the board.
No. Yeah, but they will be the majority in terms of three.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of section three, they will be the majority. Section three says non-executive members must make up the majority of members of the committee.
Mm-hmm.
So the way I'm reading it, I might be wrong. Let's put it this way. They've got the, I don't know, system operating. I'll just use the example. So there's one committee which is looking at procurement.
Mm-hmm.
So there's procurement of power.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there's a director who's appointed director within the system operator is responsible for procurement.
Mm-hmm.
So if the committee was made of three people, maybe the fourth one would be there to assist the board, would be the director responsible for procurement, sitting
mm-hmm.
with them in that committee. But then the majority, so that the decisions would be taken by the non-executive director,
mm-hmm.
the majority would be the non-executive director. But the way I'm reading it here on section 18.3.
I think it's 4.
Yes.
Thank you.
sense of East Mall, but also normal companies would still have a way of interacting with their clients. So I don't see why you should be fussy about it and insist that there must be a consultation clause here. I would assume that East Mall, in the normal course of this business, would be interacting with generators and interacting with distributors. So there will be consulting in a way.
Thank you.
in law they say delegation does not absolve you from responsibility.
Yes.
You're still finally, you still be finally held accountable for what you delegated.
Okay, fine.
And then 95, question 20. We are such a mess. Should that we need to include, consider application.
Section 21, subsection 2B says the chief executive officer and the chief financial officer may be reappointed by the board with the concurrence of the minister, but only for one such additional term not exceeding 4 years. Are we saying that the chief executive officer and the CFO can only work for ISMO for a period of 8 years? After a period of 8 years, they must leave ISMO. That's the way I'm reading this subject. Because if you look at A, they are supposed to be appointed for a term not exceeding 4 years. The question is that what is applicable in the public service? I'm asking a general question. CFOs in the public service, they stay there as long as they want, as long as their contract is being renewed. So if I'm having a 5 year contract as a CFO, I finish the 5 year contract and my brother, I'm happy with you. I'm going for another one. If it's 10. The next one is 15, 20. I can retire from the civil service and you want to retain that expertise within the civil service. But here we're treating them like board members. You see, their term, they have a term of, I'm trying to even get them, maybe judges have for 15 years, I don't know. Or, we make them like office bearers, holding some sort of public office and say you are a premier of a province, you can only serve for 2 terms. And that's it. You are a president, you are no third term here, 2 terms. That's the way I'm reading it. Why not let the CFO and the CEO? Because they are part of the board. The board can decide you are not going to renew your contract, that's it.
Thank you, Chair. From the drafting perspective, that is what it says. The CFO and CEO cannot exceed 8 years. But whether what is the motive behind from a policy perspective, that will I will say to my colleagues.
I think with regards to the CEO, that's the common most entities or stakeholder entities, they will have that provision that you cannot be there forever. It's what that pro-
train this person. Maybe, you know, tongue in cheek, maybe that explains why some of our entities are continually in problems. Because there's this huge turnover, you know, there's always turnover here. New people, and they come with all different turnarounds that need. SAA is not aggressive from our discussion. SAA has, I don't know how many turnarounds they have from Babanani, they have one from Sibiri. I think there were almost, I'm sure there should have been more than four or five, more than five turnarounds. This thing is changing all the time. The fence will never know which direction it's facing because everybody who comes there tends to get out. You know. So I'm just saying, can you just do, if that's the case, even with, I'm not sure whether in the private sector also that's the case. You want to keep your PFO just for terms. Can you just investigate that, you know, and let's see what the practice and why it's also different from the public service. The public service doesn't have that practice of where. If you are a DG, you are happy with this, you keep on renewing a contract. We don't want you, we've got the power to say, it stops now, we're not renewing the contract.
Let me try and look at it.
I'm going to deal with you from 26 to 27.
Yes.
some of the things that relate to doing property and food mechanism in place, but in other countries, it's not like it's something that happens in South Africa, but in other countries they do offer it that they enjoy finding. The person that owns the network doesn't necessarily sell the power, you know, he's just offering the network. You know, and you could, as the seller, you could instruct that person to switch off, you know, whoever that was paying. But it's something that probably is not for discussion of this legislation at this point. It's something that we need to deal with. I know in our
unforeseen and avoidable expenses, whatever that language that they used in the PFMA.
why not stop there? Just two maybe. That is 32.1 2, or just even 37.1 only. Because anybody who's owned by ISO, you know, a bondholder, would know their rights and would know how to get a remedy for and how to enforce their rights. But by opening it up here, I don't know, because we are saying then the judge must order that any prices of electricity supplied or to be supplied be increased to meet the deficit, and that a price of such order does not require the sanction of any authority. Yeah, that's definitely a difficulty. Question is why leave it, with Santal and any other entity, even with ESCOM, I don't think you will get a provision like that. If any person, if I'm a debt holder, bond holder, ESCOM is owing me and they are unable to pay. Then I was going to look for either some of their movable properties, the cars and whatever, before I even think about going to the power station, to attach a power station. So I must then satisfy the debt obligation through that. But here we're saying the charge must then increase the deal. I think that think about the other thing. We think on this.
There is no assurance that ESCOM at some having the concern here, probably I might as well deal with the next one, because the concern is that the communication with Iran. But we are of the view that given the significance of this entity and the amount of money that's going to be handling as a trader and the liabilities that it will have to the IPP, it needs to demonstrate some form of assurance that I could stand on my own and do this thing. You know? That's why we provided in the reserve give the director's power to do this. And then section 37. This was a very lengthy debate. That's why you will see that business sometimes comes as business, and sometimes they are in the network umbrella. If they come as business, it means there was disagreement at network. Then they come in and raise the issue on their own, without, you know, carrying the neck. Because we are of the view that if there is a problem at ISMO, the minister should be in a position to intervene. And we then provide in the law the steps that the minister needs to take in that process. We don't seem to believe that you can leave it openly and allow the minister to intervene in any manner in which she feels. But they're arguing that the standard practice for you SOD provides for that, but we are of the view that it needs to be filled down in the law so that we avoid any confusion. Power to in the affairs of I'm not going to go into the section itself, but I think that's the principle of what
When reading the section, I found it to be in order, except when we move into the offences and penalties. The powers that are allocated to the minister in this instance, everything looks reasonable until we go into the offence. Let me just raise the point. It says particularly concerned about C, 38(1)(c) fails to comply with the directive issued under section 37(4)(c), which is 37(4)(c) says this the minister appoints an administrator in terms of section subsection 3, and then says subsection 3. An employee or a contractor of ISMO must comply with the directive given by the administrator. And you know, almost if I don't comply with that directive, it criminalizes me. My challenge is, let me give you a practical example. I'm not familiar with this thing, I'm just building a hypothetical case here. The administrator, the board is dissolved because they couldn't fulfill the responsibilities that they were assigned to. And the minister gave them a reasonable time, you know, the whole of state service. The administrator comes in, and I'm an employee of ISMO, and says, the minister says to me, switch off that power plant no, you are not bringing that guy on stream. I said, no, I'm bringing on stream, and I'm not going to take your directive because your directive is unwritten. You can get off one. Because the administrator is giving, you're saying, please fail to comply with the directive issued under section 37.4c. And 37.4c says, if the minister appoints an administrator in terms of section, subsection 3, it then says an employee or a contractor of ISMO must comply with the directive given by the administrator. I know, I mean, it's open for the courts to interpret whether that directive was unfair or, you know, unreasonable.
Mm-hmm.
But if a new administrator comes in and it's a bully, it's a bully and say, you know, when you hear my footsteps, then you must know my order must be carried out. 1, 2, 3 things have not been done. If then you don't comply with what I'm saying to you, then it's a criminal offense in a way. You need to be charged and appear before the court. I'm saying I must be stretching you too far, but that's just my concern. That well, maybe after the courts, the courts would have to determine whether that directive was unreasonable and whether that directive would constitute a criminal offence. Because we are saying there's a fine of a person is guilty of an offence and liable on conviction to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 5 years, or both a fine and such an imprisonment. I would assume, and I think this is where the state law advisor might assist us, I assume the directives, you know, the non-compliance of these would have to be dealing with serious offences. Because if it's open-ended, you know, I don't know, it's up to the courts to determine whether they are serious offences or not. But if the administrator says, man, you must do the following and you don't do that, and then you are liable for a fine or a sentence not exceeding 5 years, and then you come out of prison, maybe by luck if you still work for ISMO or somewhere else, you repeat another offense, you repeat another offense, then you're going in for 10 years now.
I'm just finishing it because from a lay person, I mean, I would assume this would apply to very serious offenses, or there was instruction would be legal instruction, and people should not be hampering the functioning of this.
Okay, no, that's a valid point, I guess then, even though the courts will be interpreting the legislation, there's no harm in qualifying the powers that are given to the administrator, unless there's an objection from the policy side. You can work on sub 4 and also on the offences to link it so that there's an element of reasonableness or some test there.
All the way up to 180, but all of the things we say.
if it's not applicable to all other legislation. For instance, if on any what are these companies act or whatever, the minister is not obliged to consult but can issue regulations. Question is why would you want to insist that on this one the minister was consulted. If the process normally starts, then I don't know how, what's the process of this new regulation. See, the problem is that they want to do consultation twice, but other legislations are silent on the issue of consultation regulation. Why do you want to insist on putting it in?
Thank you, Chair. I think it depends really on that field. So it may be based purely on policy, on technicality of this field. Other legislations are silent about consultation. Others insist. And the turn of late has been on insisting on the consultation. But at the same time, let's not be influenced by that. Let's just look at the policy behind the consultation here at ISMO, and then the functioning of the board and the independence of the whole institute.
But can we check, can we,
Dr.
Dr.
also the minister is covered but says that it's after consultation, so meaning you can't delay the process. It's just considering and reasonable time can period can be put in place that the minister can still go ahead with the work.
Okay, let's proceed.
that you would want to leave that, because they are 100% shareholder of Eskom, 100% shareholder of Eskom. You'd want to leave the discussion between National Treasury and the DOE to come to a certain conclusion around the effort that they owe, you know, and decide how they will, if they want to compensate Eskom, how are they going to do it, all those types of things. I think maybe it's important that you should not even try to put a lot of detail in the legislation, because we don't know what the shareholder would say. So if, for instance, the shareholder say, yeah, I put out my asset, let me give you an instruction of what I want to do those types of things, I own 100% of Eskom. So, and on that system of arrangement, I'm saying you shift there to shift everything to system of arrangement. Leave it to me. With the point that you have always made, but leave it to me. I'll see how I'll unpack that role. I might give you more guarantees, whatever. So I think let's leave it to the discussion between the DOE, National Treasury, and the DPE to see how they will deal with the assets that have been taken by from Eskom.
But to give confidence, how and where would you capture that? Accepting what one of the workers is saying.
I mean, the plan chairperson is that we need to choose from wide regulation that needs to be set.
Yeah.
That's the idea.
That's where you would catch us.
You can capture it in regulation. Actually, we are even saying we need to hold capital.
state a multi-case strategy, and then the business plan actually looks at operational issues now in detail, which we in ourselves on the model, from time to time can make reference to monitor the progress, like what the minister will be doing as well. But it depends where some of the things that are raised here could be located. This triggers me particularly our vision to take detailed issues and throw them into a principal area.
Yeah, certainly, I think you're right. Because if you look at section 41, I know I'm jumping there. It's very clear, you know, that the minister would be in charge of the process. And the concerns that it might be expressed by other people on about unnecessary delay, I think maybe might be misplaced. Because section 41, subsection 4, says the minister may, in consultation with cabinet, determine by noticing the government gazette the day for transferring of the functions referred to in subsection 2. And 5, the notice referred to in subsection 4 must provide a detailed plan and measures for the transfer of such functions in order to ensure continuity of electricity supply.
Yeah,
that's
so I'm saying covered. Okay.
I think we're gonna go straight to things. I think 129 is one page. I think we dealt with one page as well. Protective page issue. We sort of covered our presentation on 41. But I think the thing that we sort of want to flag is that we then put together the regulations that need to be added at the end of the section. I think it's section 39. We sort of flagged it. But these regulations are not new. We sort of took them from the body of the Act and sort of pushed them down to section 39. I'm not going to fall into them. Okay, Musa raised the point that not all functions need to be performed by ESCOM. We agree with that. And certainly we can bring more clarity. do that. As we prepare the business case, these are one of the things that we will be looking at and have debate with national treasury, even in terms of how do we list this entity and the TFMA, which shape it will fall under, and what financial support that treasury will provide, and even if the interim phase where you're still establishing this entity doesn't have any money, doesn't have any assets, you know, what is it that we would have to do for this entity? We might have to give some startup costs, which might have to come in here, but even the cost, how much that startup cost going to be, it's going to be based on the business case and the employees that will be in place at that point. You could stagger it into different phases. Who is going to appoint that? Is that the minister of the board? Let us say, and then follow by the CEO, then we sort of go all the way down to the last person. And then even the startup cost that you will have to request from treasury will have to be all of the particular time. And we're saying that those are the things that we would have to engage treasury on and agree on how it is. And ISMA should be a viable entity. We agree with that. ISMA must be a viable entity. That's why we have to ask that point. I think the point here is that if it's a viable entity, you need to be clear about the customer. And I think this is the energy intensive user group. I suppose the argument is that they would always prefer to fix power than the whole day level. I think that's what is always cheaper for you to buy there. Actually, there are issues as you speak with some of the large customers that are located within distribution. They are not interested to be part of distribution. They want to buy power directly from wholesale. And there are constitutional issues around that also with regard to municipality. Some, they are even willing to build their own land, you know, parallel to the municipal land, straight to transmission so that they can get power directly from the wholesale part, which is a debate on its own. Some of the things that we need to tackle. I'm just mentioning that to bring your attention to the comments that you mentioned. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
I'm taking back. I had a look again on the. I'm not taking back. I'm just saying. I had a look again on that issue of the borrowings. I think it would be in order to leave it as it is. Because the explanation of the letter of comfort really motivates for why you need that. Especially given that this was starting, so there will be a weaker balance sheet from onset. If you want to leave this thing in favor, I think that is quite a good.
Now, with money and society, we just went to draw our last kind of directive to come through the statement as an initial step towards our goal. Unfortunately, we're not all here. We have to, rather unfortunately, almost the same as the sentence, but of course, at a faster rate for the benefit of the other members, and we hope to be the advisors to the sponsors, particularly the advisors, could help us to try and start imagining something which others could consider now, a year or nay on. Yeah.
I agree with you. I think if the drafters could then take these proposals that we're making and then shorten the thing, you know, things that are not necessary so that we can present it before the committee and motivate why. I think that would also shorten the process.
Thank you very much.